So Anya Galaccio, we're in a space just behind Oxford Street, which is called Figure One, curated by Mark Francis. It's a space that has a continuous series of projects and programs and interventions that last just a week. You have a piece here installed which is intriguing, I think. It's a photographic piece, about 6 foot square. It's a landscape. It's not exactly a meadow. It's a section of a landscape that often occurs on the edge of fields in the country with a marshy swamp with cut down trees. You're actually lying in it on your back, semi-submerged in water. So immediately there's all sorts of narratives that are beginning to come to mind, and one starts to construct meanings around what we see here. That's on one level. On another level, it's very reminiscent of a very traditional English landscape painting, and I kept thinking about Constable.
It was a photograph that I wanted to take for a really long time, for about a year. And when I started thinking about it, I suppose initially I just thought it was such a kind of cliched idea that I wasn't sure if I dared do it. And I'm partly nervous about talking about it in case that closes down how people respond to it, because now it's a piece of work. And I think it's become something other than my reasons for making it. I'm very curious about painting, and a lot of people often talk about painting in relation to what I do, and I'm terrified of painting. I've never painted. And when I made this actual image, I was very much thinking, this particular photograph here, about painting, and I'd been looking a lot at the Millet Ophelia in the Tate, and trying to find a place which had the same kind of colours and the same kind of textures, but also some kind of idea of the English landscape. And so I spent about 6 or 7 months trying to find this place. And I was interested in much more in making an image of the landscape that there was a figure in, and not it being about the figure. I mean, the main thing is the space and is the landscape and the place. And I suppose it seemed important that it was me in the photograph. Well, partly because I felt I kind of got trapped in this idea of being the flower girl, even though that is a really small part of my practice. And I'm always kind of surprised by people's surprise that I actually have a much larger kind of repertoire of materials and projects than the flower works. And I kind of felt that in a way making this image was a way of a kind of transitional point between finishing that, not being that person anymore, and being able to do something else in a very kind of obvious kind of way. And also it seemed more and more that this notion of celebrity and the artist as celebrity seems to be becoming more and more kind of prevalent, especially in London. And I feel very ambivalent about that, and I'm not really interested in being in my work in that way. Some people said that this was kind of like a murder.
I mean, there are lots of ways of reading it, clearly. One of them, for me, does of course make reference to Ophelia, the Millet Ophelia painting, but the other inescapably seems to be that of the scene of the crime. So, I mean, those are inevitable readings that people will make.
I mean, I suppose, but I speak to me as it's kind of an image of regeneration. Image as a kind of, as the end of one thing and the beginning of something else. And somehow the actual place, it felt like quite a kind of primeval bit of forest with all this kind of huge let pond with all this green algae growing on the top and these other trees breaking down and growing. Yet there's this kind of real evidence of, you know, culture, man, whatever you want to say, because there's all these logs that are chopped which were around the edge, and I didn't move anything, I didn't construct the image, I just framed it very carefully when I went with the camera. I didn't cut the fallen tree.
You use the word regeneration. Could you expand on that?
Well, I just think that things are kind of cycles and that they go around, and as things break down and decay, other things kind of grow and come out of that, and I never see death as a kind of end point. There's, you know, some other activity, some other kind of energy or life comes out of that. So all these things are growing there. It's invisible in the picture. It's about being able to let go of, you know, 10 years and to move into the future this felt like an image that kind of works symbolically for me in a personal way about what I am doing now. And also it feels like at this time in London with the new Tate opening, I don't know, I just feel quite confused about what has happened in London over the last 10 years and what is happening now and my position in that as being somebody that was part of Frieze, that, you know, is of the generation of Gary Hume and Sarah Lucas, and then my contemporaries, Damien, you know, how I've negotiated the last 10 years. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very successful and I've achieved a lot. But the path that I chose to take was very different. Now that a lot of the kind of institutions have really invested a lot into certain aspects of this history, it's quite interesting being consciously aware of being part of history. History always seemed to me something that was very distant and removed. And all of a sudden, over the last couple of years, I realised that I'm part of a history, and I started seeing more and more that history being misrepresented by people who know what the history really is, and I became more and more, and am more and more bemused by why that should be necessary.
I mean, are you saying that by committing yourself to temporal kinds of works that don't necessarily lead to artefacts that can be appropriated and presented in museums or sold to dealers, that you somehow therefore separate yourself at the same time from a lot of what has arisen out of that whole Frieze group?
I haven't separated myself, but I have been separated. And I don't think that's about people not supporting me, because I do feel that I know I'm supported, and I know people are interested in what I do and they have encouraged me. But it just seems to be that the institutions don't seem to be able to.
But don't you think that institutions are susceptible to a certain range of strategies, if you like? They're susceptible to strategies that actually do lead to objects?
Well, I think that's their problem. I don't see why that should be my problem. But I think it's an interesting issue, and I think that a lot of artists are working in that way. So I suppose I see the role of the institution to accommodate what is going on. I don't see why artists should adapt themselves to fit into those institutions. A lot of artists do, and to me that's not particularly interesting. And
I have actually, you know, been quite concerned with this debate myself, and what I've often got back from curators and critics is that, well, if artists don't work in the way that museums can kind of appropriate their objects and outputs, then they shouldn't blame the museum.
I'm not blaming the museum. I'm really nervous now about this conversation, like that I sound like I'm bitter or angry. I'm not in the slightest bit. But I think it's a debate, and I think it's really important, and I think that I'm disappointed in the institutions and a lot of people that I respect and think are highly intelligent and should be able to discuss and deal with these ideas. And I'm also disappointed in the way that a lot of artists choose not to even consider these issues because they're just so keen to be absorbed into the institution. So nothing changes. We're in another century now, and we're still functioning in a way that was invented, you know, in the 19th century, more or less. And I find that deeply distressing and kind of confusing, really. A lot of it has been invested in some very outmoded idea of ownership and collections, which I suppose is why a space like this is exciting for me, that it can function and it's been so successful that people are still on the 26th, 27th week really excited and coming to see what is here. But, and it's also been interesting to see how different artists have used it in different ways. I mean, whether they use it as a way of testing something out or of showing something that would not be able to be seen in London.
It demonstrates another kind of model, doesn't it, which can be temporary, which can be for a week at a time, and works can come in and go out, and it can still be very focused, very vital.
Yeah, and also that model hasn't got any desire to be alternative. One of the ideas out of Frieze and the motivation for that and the whole spate of shows that happened after that and are still happening did not kind of grow out of a desire to be alternative, to avoid the market, to avoid being part of the mainstream. It was about the fact at that point there weren't any spaces that were available to the artists, and we all got a bit ahead of ourselves and didn't see why we should wait. So certain things have changed, but it now feels like we're going backwards. And so I suppose that's my frustration, that the artist seemed to make some kind of impact on something and now it's kind of going backwards again, and I suppose I'd like to see another leap happen.
I was interested in your references to being known as the flower girl, and there are surely red flowers around the body, and you use the term regeneration, and I wondered the extent to which this could be seen as, I don't like the word milestone, but it's a kind of a point that opens up all sorts of other possibilities, maybe.
Oh no, it's a huge milestone for me. I mean, and that's why it's taken me such a long time to make this work, and for other artists or critics, people looking at this image, they probably don't understand why it should be such a big deal, but I suppose I felt like I'd invested so much in not making things that lasted, that it was I felt like if I'm going to make something that lasts, I have to be really, really careful about how I do it, because it's got to be about making it, because that's the way, in making something that has to be made in that way, not about making something that lasts.
Were the red flowers actually there in the pond?
No, that's the only other thing that's added, me and the red flowers. I kind of thought, well, I can't really do Ophelia without the flowers. Gerberas were my signature flower. And at one point, I was going to be face down in the water. Anyway, they're not red gerberas, they're just red flowers. And there's a second version of this image that I made, which is in the Listen show at the moment, which is exactly the same image. And I digitally removed myself, and there's just the flowers there. And it's a very small image. It's only about 20 inches square. And I was quite intrigued with the idea of having this place in two different places at the same time. And maybe people seeing both images and maybe making the connection.
It seems to me quite interesting, and maybe something you'd like to talk about, how you can make two images, and this one, the actual chemistry of the figure within that landscape seems to me to create a kind of a whole set of tensions and dialogue and so on. Without the figure, it would be something else.
I was kind of shocked by the image when I saw it, because even though I'd thought about it for months and months and discussed it for weeks with Wendy, I'd still tried to leave it as open in my head. I didn't know which way how I was going to lie down when I was there, whether I was going to be face down or which way around I was going to be. And I'd been and looked at that place several times. But we walked around for about an hour with the camera, setting up different, like looking through the viewfinder. It was a bit like a dream in the back of my head. I didn't focus on it that clearly because I didn't really want to illustrate it as an idea. I find it is quite a disturbing and unsettling image. So I suppose then I became curious just to see how I would respond to the image if I wasn't in it.
Did you think of using a model?
It wasn't about illustrating Ophelia. It had to be me. I wasn't going to kill myself, but it just seemed that if I was going to make this gesture, even though, you know, 99 of the 100 people that see it will not know any of my kind of complicated and ridiculous reasons for making this image, it was just seemed that it had to be me. Even though I really did not want to get in that water and it was disgusting and really unpleasant, I just felt it had to be me that was lying there and being Ophelia or whatever that person is.
I mean, a sense of authenticity, it has to be.
Flower girl, yeah.
There's a reference to Marcel Duchamp's Étant donné, which is a very sexual piece. How do you think about that in relation to the piece and the reading of the piece?
Well, I suppose, I mean, again, it's just full of clichés. Like the forest and the kind of fertility of the forest is, in a clichéd way, sexual. So I suppose it's a kind of combination of all those clichéd notions and whether they actually become something else when it is an image or not. But also, I suppose, this kind of fetishization of the artist at the moment, it's not particularly interesting. I suppose that's why this is a kind of work that works on two different levels. It doesn't matter who that person is. There's a figure in a forest, in this water. There's that whole kind of narrative going on. And then on another level, for some people, that is Anya Galaccio on her back, in this mud, in this forest. And what does that mean? And so there's these two different narratives going on. And for some people, the second narrative will be what interests them. Then that's why I kind of lay slightly like that. It's not really like the Étant donné pose at all, but Duchamp has been, you know, a pivotal artist, and he's really influenced this whole generation of artists, the kind of YBAs, whatever. So it just seemed somehow appropriate I mean, I was really shocked when I actually saw it in real life. I haven't actually ever read anything about it, which is very lazy of me, but I would see it in reproduction, so somehow I always thought it was a painting, and it was just so shocking to see it, and that whole thing of, like, putting your eye up against the door and peering through, and that just seems to be, in a kind of weird way, this obsession at the moment here with that's what people want. They want to know about the artist, they want to know, and a lot of artists here are really happy to indulge that. Seem to be much more comfortable with doing that than doing their work. And I think that's all fine. It's just about keeping that balance, really, about who is applauded more, and my unease with what I feel is happening here, and this period of time being the end of something, not only for me, but for a lot of people, I think. You know, I'm preparing to go forward and to be a grown-up version of me, whatever, I don't know, to continue making work. I'm not giving up. But I feel like there's a time to stop quoting freeze and to stop using that as some kind of tag to be handy. No, that's a long time ago.
It is an extraordinary moment, actually, and contemporary visual art has sort of been in the shadows for a long time, but in the last year or so, particularly with the opening of Tate Modern, it's been foregrounded in the way that it's never been foregrounded before. 3 or 4 months ago, you couldn't open any paper without some reference to visual arts, photographs of artists. Now the colour supplements have them on a regular basis.
Well, except that it hasn't really moved the debate on. We still get this kind of trashy tabloid journalism, cool blimey, you know, is this really art? And I suppose that's partly my disappointment, is that, yes, artists are now pop stars, and artists can earn quite considerable amounts of money for their work or fees. We can have a respectable, you know, decent living. But it hasn't actually pushed forward any debate. It hasn't actually made the general public feel any more confident in viewing, looking at artworks. Yes, Tate Modern is absolutely jam-packed, but I think a lot of that is out of some kind of search for glamour. And I'm not against glamour. I suppose I just feel, you know, you present something in a slightly different way and it's just more intelligent.
You wanted the word milestone to be used in the discussion about this piece. It is clearly a point at which you want the debate to move on. And this is a very unusual piece for you. So there is a sense in which a leap has taken place in terms of your practice.
No, it totally wants to move forward. It's a critique of myself, and it's a critique of all sorts of things, and it's also a very seductive and beautiful image. But it works on lots of different levels, and it's, I suppose, a way of forcing me, personally, to jump and to embrace certain aspects of the real problems of being an artist, about making money and working with institutions, that I've kind of avoided. I've kind of hoped that some of those questions would be answered for me, or I'd be helped with those problems by the institutions, and I haven't been. They see that as my job. I have got to try and resolve that, and how can I now continue to make works which are still mine without losing or giving up anything that I did over the last 10 years, because I don't regret any of that at all. And I feel I've made a really substantial body of work, but I also recognise I need to keep my brain going as well. And is it possible for me to make images, or to work in bronze, or work in more stable materials which will make certain people feel less uneasy, and still produce the work that I've been producing, if that makes any sense? I don't want to change the content or the motivation for the work, but somehow I'm trying to see if I can make it in a different way. And it feels like it would have been really inappropriate for me to do that before. That's kind of my project at the moment, to see if I can kind of mix, you know, things that are still mutable, things that aren't fixed, with things that appear to be fixed. And maybe it makes me look like I'm playing the game a bit more. I don't know really.
I'm here with Ed Roche at the Anthony Doffe Gallery. I'd like to begin by talking about two works in the exhibition, Blast Curtain and Crash Cushion.
Let's see. Well, I've been painting words for about maybe 40 years now. Any words that I use have to have some kind of attachment or connection to my daily life, I think. And Blast Curtain, particularly, I've always liked that term because it defines this kind of metal barrier that you find at airports. and they're called blast curtains that stop the jet noise. It just has a particular kind of vitality. Same way with crash cushion. I just, you know, it's something about the combination of that that makes me want to do a picture of it.
The words you select do have not only this wonderful feel for language, but also this fantastic juxtaposition, as you say, of the hard and the smooth, or this almost a surreal aspect to them.
You know, I wish I could quickly describe how my affinity to words came about, but I can't say that it really came through poetry. I can't say that it came through literature. I think it came through mostly my exposure to popular culture and radio, TV, movies. All of this comes about through my interest with maybe popular culture.
Another painting I'd like to talk about is Parking for Tower Records' book Soup. And it struck me this great way you have of being provocative and ironic at the same time. Also, you choose these mountains which are majestic, beautifully painted. And then the words as well, there is a frisson between the way the words are simply placed on the ground. In some of them, they stop you, you know, they arrest your gaze. In others, they pull your gaze in.
The parking pictures came directly from my experience of driving down Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. And like Book Soup is a bookstore that's on Sunset Strip. And these other places exist. They are actual locations on the Sunset Strip. Mountains are more like ideas of mountains rather than mountains. People might point to it and say, well, what mountain is that? And I can't really say. I'm a nature boy, but I can't say that I would ever want to go to a mountain and set up a canvas and paint it. It just doesn't have that meaning to me. It's more like I need to have it transcribed through the noise of modern life and communications. Art making is a, at least for me, is a very sort of convulsive effort, and it sort of requires certain spastic hormones to create something, and this could add up to me saying, I don't know what I'm doing. But I just think that the process of art making is kind of an unintelligible act, and anybody who thinks that they have it down or understand it totally is missing the point. I think making art has to come from all kinds of illogical sources and illogical steps. They can end up being heroic steps, they can end up being stupid steps, but making pictures is a matter of like shoveling stuff into a little container, and that's the picture.
Just going back to some of your earlier works again, the prints that you've made, and also one that you recently remade, which was Chocolate, which is the one you made for the Venice Biennale. And I was interested to read about that there was some controversy surrounding that, whether you would exhibit or not. And then the actual chocolate that you used on the prints was then schooled into. Was that true?
Yeah. It was a spin-off of a project that I worked on here in London in 1970. I did a series of silk screen prints, and I titled them News, Muse, Pews, Brews, Stews, Do's. It just sort of developed into using these organic materials like caviar and axle grease, and using actual flowers to run through the silk screen, and I used chocolate also in one. And this Venice Biennale business was happening, and I wanted to make a project with a capital P, I guess you would say. And so I did something that I had not really done before, which is make some sort of installation. It's the closest thing to an installation that I've ever done. Chocolate, literally silk-screened, almost like wallpaper, or shingles is a better term for it. And these shingles were just hung like you would hang shingles on a wall, and to cover the entire inside of this room. And yes, the chocolate was a little sticky, but people would come in and they would mark in the, put peace and love signs and all of that sort of thing. So
did you find that fun? I mean, were you interested in that?
No, I didn't want to encourage that, and I was probably wise not to.
I also want to talk about some of your earlier paintings, particularly when you set the Los Angeles Museum on fire in your painting.
Well, you know, I consider myself being very closely allied to abstract painting, and that means like non-objective painting. I mean, I can look at the mountains with the words and I still see the abstractness of them. Something draws me to the world of abstract art. In that picture you're speaking of, the L.A. County Museum on Fire, I was at the time involved in aerial photography, and it was like a perfect source material for a painting. I can't exactly say why I did it. Maybe it was my attack against an authority figure of the day, which I felt needed attacking, and that's the concept of an art museum.
You've also experimented with shaped canvases. The words seem to push the edges of the canvas out.
I think it was something accidental that moved me in that direction. And I think I looked at a canvas once that was badly stretched and had this bow to it. Maybe I felt like there was a something about the pictures that maybe tricked you into believing you were getting a little bit more of a picture than you really were, and I like that idea.
I'd like to talk about some works which are loosely titled Metro Plots, which are hanging in this exhibition.
These paintings sort of came out of the woodwork starting about 2 years ago, where I guess maybe it's a return to something else. It's almost like that painting, the LA County Museum on Fire, where you're looking at something from the air, and you're looking at an oblique. There's a couple of paintings here in England that that I've always referred to when I think about my County Museum on Fire, which is one is Ophelia, which is that painting at the Tate, and another is done by an artist named Yurik. He painted a picture about the Battle of Dunkirk. At a distance, looks like a very pastoral, oblique, again, aerial view of the city of Dunkirk being bombed. Anyway, these pictures, I somehow both have some kind of, I refer to those paintings when I think about my work, and not any less with these Metro Plots pictures either. You're looking at things from aerial view. And then I began making these pictures of streets in Los Angeles and how they intersect and all that. I've kept pretty close to geographical descriptions and locations of streets and their intersections and all of that. And then from there I went to the national map and started using cities. If you took a straight line or a rule and put it on the map, you would see that these cities all line up together.
They're devoid of color, whereas the other works in the exhibition are, I've got this wonderful, the blue, the white, the hints of red and the lettering. You think quite clearly in your work very much about what colours you'll use, how you'll use colours. Can we talk a little bit about your use of colour?
Sure. I always thought that although I like to use colour in things, I don't necessarily think a painting or a picture has to be colourful. I knew at one point that I would somewhere reach my period of using black and white. I did it a few years ago when I was doing some pictures that involved silhouettes, and so I began to get into the idea of using various kinds of black against white, and also using an air gun and an airbrush, which I always despised. Oh, I never liked airbrush art, and here I am doing it. It has an effect that I like that I didn't want to confused with the idea of using color with it. I like limiting it to black and white. And so there they are.
I'd like to talk about some of your projects to do with the books you've made, because that's interesting as well. And you continue to do that. You've made quite a few of those. And the small books that you also made, the small books of photographs of things like the Hollywood Hotel, Sunset Boulevard, 26 gasoline stations.
Apartments. Yeah, well, photography, I've always given it great credence and respect. And I felt somehow I was coming into the world developing as an artist and seeing that the factual aspects of life had to be somehow captured. It all came together in these books that I was doing because I was traveling, I liked to drive. So I began seeing subject matter there that had to be almost like brought back and reported on. So I was photographing gasoline stations for a couple of years there and identifying these and describing their locations, using a camera as though it was a recording tool rather than a means to a work of art.
Again, what's interesting is, of course, looking back at those works now, the wonderful use of lettering in them, and you look at them and the signage is just so beautiful. Of course, they now have taken on a very historic aspect. They also have that kind of nostalgic feel to them that's quite magical when you look at them.
Well, that's what I was afraid of when I did those. That was the furthest thing from my mind, was to have those gas stations become objects of nostalgia. I wanted them to be today, this is now. There's no nostalgia, which I find to be a crutch in the world of art. A lot of artists depend on nostalgia and things that are gone. It's like out with the new and in with the old. And the idea of making that book was the most important thing. The photographs were actually secondary. I think that the title of the book, 26 Gasoline Stations, came to me before I even knew that there might be 26 worth putting in the book.
So why 26?
It had this roundness to it, a softness to it, almost like an artist will pick one model over another, you know. It's just, but not that there would be any sort of riddle or anything that would lead you to get the punchline. It's just I wanted to operate in kind of a neutral territory. And I felt like the book was something that was never really approached by artists. It had been by the futurists and some artists that made Leave Deluxe books. But I wanted mine to be more like something that was commercially produced, and I wanted something that would make people's heads scratch.
When you made your work with stains, which kind of relates to multiples, what did that come from?
Well, the stain works came out of a frustrated attempt to escape from the idea of putting a skin on a canvas, which was like oil paint, you know. And I got to the point where I couldn't paint anymore, and I didn't know why. And I began to realize that there are other things you can do to a surface than put a skin on them. So it was an escape from the skin, I guess you could say it was. It got to be where I was staining the support and staining the canvas rather than laying something down on top of it. So it had a different, it opened up a different world.
Are you interested in opening up different worlds still in your work?
I guess one of my favorite artists is Giorgio Morandi, and he painted the same picture for all of his life. And did it very well, and you never had to look for any kind of variety in this man's work. You know, he fulfilled his destiny without even doing any of this pushing into new frontiers. So pushing into a new frontier is not a necessity for any artist, but unless it's done by someone else, things end up at a standstill. I get back to this idea that there's some indescribable thing that happens and make you want to make art, and this is a collection of a bunch of those frustrations, and I feel like I've been painting the same picture for 40 years, and yet how it comes to be is you know, that's one of the hardest things to describe.